It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Milwaukee Police Department reports about a 21% drop in homicides for 2023 compared to the previous year. We examine the challenges of gun violence and prevention efforts that are underway, and you can join the discussion. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Constance Kostelak is an assistant professor in the Division of Epidemiology and Social Sciences at the Medical College of Wisconsin, leads the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission. Constance, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Looking at these numbers, Milwaukee recording 215 homicides in 2022, 173 homicides in 2023. Why is this type of violence declining in the city?
So it is always a really challenging question when we're looking at decreases in crime and violence in particular. There's always multiple factors that are at play. I think part of what's important to understand is that we are seeing some national trends in other cities in terms of a decrease as well. And there seems to be at least some indication that we have a connection to the distance from the pandemic, as well as the unrest in 2020 that was experienced across the country. At the same time, I think part of what we should talk about is some of the unique things that are happening in Milwaukee that we think are contributing to the decrease here as well. Compared to other cities, we don't have all of the information for every city in the country yet, but compared to some of the other major cities, we've actually seen a bigger decrease, which is very encouraging.
Okay, and we're going to get to the investments in gun violence intervention in a moment. But when you look at what is happening in Milwaukee, comparing it to the national homicide numbers, data here from AH Datalytics, nationally dropping around 12% across more than 170 cities last year from 2022, what might be happening with homicide rates falling nationally?
So nationally, I think a lot of the experts across the country are focusing on what really is many aspects of returning to pre-pandemic factors. So we've got both the return to more regular services. We have the focus on reducing backlog within the criminal justice system across the country. But I also think, just as we do here in Milwaukee, we are seeing a lot more investment in thinking about prevention opportunities and looking at taking more of a public health approach to addressing gun violence, both here and across the country.
A public health approach. Do you feel that gun violence is specifically connected to a public health issue, a public health problem?
Absolutely. We really are trying to focus on thinking about gun violence, the way gun violence is transmitted across communities. But more importantly, I think looking at the public health approach to gun violence as this really being a major public health issue, but also that we can think about levels of prevention then in how we focus on the ways that we address gun violence. So we can think about more upstream or primary prevention from an education standpoint, but we also can think about responses that are after the fact, after we have incidents of gun violence. How do we also help to prevent further incidents from happening by responding to those incidents, providing services, providing support and resources? So the public health approach really does give us a lens by which to look at gun violence as a disease, and how can we collectively work together on prevention and think about how it connects to things like social determinants of health and factors that are influencing the lives of families, individuals, and the community.
We're talking about the decrease in gun-related violence, looking at the overall numbers from 2023 in Milwaukee with Constance Kostelak, the head of the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission. You can join in with questions and comments along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Constance, as you lead the Homicide Review Commission, you work closely with police to make sense of the data on lethal violence in Milwaukee and develop these prevention strategies. which areas of the city experienced the most significant drops in homicides and non-fatal shootings last year? What stands out?
So we certainly are seeing decreases overall, and I think part of what we try to focus on is making sure that we are understanding areas and neighborhoods that are disproportionately impacted, but also we don't want to stigmatize those areas in terms of the perception. There's so much complexity behind what's happening in particular neighborhoods. But just as an example, both the Amani neighborhood and Sherman Park neighborhoods have experienced pretty substantial decreases between 2022 and 2023. That's mirrored certainly in other neighborhoods across the city, but I think we're also seeing a combination of resources being put into some of the neighborhoods and a variety of different strategies, both at the community level as well as with organizations that are doing collaborative work in and around these neighborhoods. We've got some other areas that have remained a bit more level from 2022 to 2023, but some of those areas are also areas that are continuing to receive concentrated efforts in terms of various strategies to focus on reducing gun violence.
Let's bring on a call. Brian is with us in DeForest. Brian, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Good morning. So my question is actually With regards to the suicide rate. I was wondering if there was perhaps a correlation between the two or not. I know that gun violence, suicide is a big factor.
Brian, thank you. Constance, go ahead.
That is a really great question, and we actually have a whole team at the Comprehensive Injury Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin that's focused specifically on understanding suicide and conducting both research and community engaged work. That's led by Dr. Sarah Kolbeck, and they really do look at, similar to what we're doing for community gun violence, the factors that are related to what we're seeing with suicide. And we do certainly see some connection and overlap in the trends between what we have for community gun violence and what we have for suicide. And unfortunately, the use of firearms is a significant part of that. But there's also a lot of other factors that that group takes a look at on a regular basis. They also do review cases of suicide incidents to also better understand what's happening within Milwaukee County.
We also heard from Mike in Williams Bay calling in to ask whether there's been a decrease or an increase in non-fatal shootings in Milwaukee and how that compares.
That's a really great question. We did see a decrease both in homicides and in non-fatal shootings. The decrease in non-fatal shootings was not as substantial as what we saw in homicides. So we had about a 4% decrease in non-fatal shootings. But both of these, considering the high level of increase that we saw in 2020, 21, and 22, the fact that we are seeing this downward trend is really encouraging. We certainly don't want to rest here. This is an encouraging trend, but we want to see not only getting back to pre-pandemic levels, but even lower than pre-pandemic levels. Any loss of life, any shooting is too many.
Constance Kostelak is an assistant professor in the Division of Epidemiology and Social Sciences at the Medical College of Wisconsin, leads the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission. As we discuss violent crime and how to prevent it, you can join in, call in with a question, share your perspective at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee shooting deaths fell last year after 3 years of record-breaking violence in the city. We examine next steps for prevention and community intervention, and you can be part of the discussion by calling in with a question, sharing your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Medical College of Wisconsin epidemiologist Constance Kostelak as director of the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission. Constance, I want to go further on programs for intervention, for prevention. What efforts are underway to reduce gun-related violence in Milwaukee?
There are a significant number of efforts that are underway, and one of the things that we are talking a lot about is that there's really an ecosystem developing around community violence intervention and gun violence prevention efforts. And part of what's so important is that we're seeing not only individual initiatives, and certainly can't name them all, but between the 41 for Life community and hospital-based violence intervention program, the Credible Messengers program, work coming out of the Office of Community Wellness and Safety, partnerships with the work of the Milwaukee Police Department, just to name a few. Part of what we're seeing is collaboration across these initiatives at a really unprecedented level, and working on how do we work together to provide the support and resources, and really do the levels of prevention that I mentioned earlier from a public health perspective, to look at not only how do we respond after incidents occur, but how do we put strategies in place that are proactive and looking at the ways that we can prevent future incidents from occurring.
Let's zoom in on one of the things you mentioned, 414 Life, which I understand is housed in the Medical College of Wisconsin. One aspect of that is violence disruptors and being, you know, deployed in neighborhoods that are considered hotspots. Is that ongoing?
It is ongoing. We actually just recently completed an evaluation of the initial few years of the 414 Life program, but the program is not only continuing, but has had some expansion as well. And you are correct that there is a focus on community violence intervention. So violence interrupters and outreach workers are doing work within the community, responding to violent incidents, working with individuals to try to prevent retaliation and future incidents of violence. And that's complemented by the hospital component of the program that responds to gunshot wound victim survivors that are coming through the hospital system and are in need of connection to resources or assistance with preventing retaliation or looking at ways to address their immediate needs in the aftermath of a shooting.
To prevent retaliation and to really disrupt, mediation, I understand, is also an intervention tactic. Is that approach, I wonder, though, quick enough or does it move fast enough to address an issue when a gun can change, you know, can change a situation in a heartbeat?
It's part of the goal is to respond quickly when incidents have occurred. And that does happen both at the hospital level and at the community level. But it's also then to look at how do we prevent incidents that may occur because of ongoing disputes or ongoing retaliation. So there's community outreach that occurs even before incidents happen. So looking at working in concentrated areas within the focus neighborhoods to work proactively to try to understand if there are emerging issues, work with community members to look at those more proactive prevention strategies in addition to mediating ongoing conflicts. So there's a lot of efforts that are tied to mediation, both upfront as well as after incidents occur.
Sounds very much like a wraparound approach. I want to address young people falling to this violence. More than 40% of murder victims in Milwaukee were younger than 25. What challenges does the city face in reducing gun deaths among young people in particular?
I think there's both a number of challenges, but also a number of opportunities. We certainly did see an increase, particularly in youth under the age of 18 that were victims of homicides and non-fatal shootings, particularly in the early part of the year. The good news is we did see a decrease the last few months, but there's really a combination of factors. We have access to firearms certainly being part of the concern. We have a very high proportion of the homicides in the city and those involving young people that are involving a firearm. We also have the role of social media poses both challenges and opportunities. We have situations that escalate maybe in ways that they wouldn't otherwise without the presence of social media, but it also does provide opportunities to communicate differently and to look at ways that we might be able to share information through social media from a prevention standpoint as well. But we also really, heading into 2024, want to see an enhanced amount of involvement, particularly with youth and young adults, but with the community as a whole in gun violence prevention efforts. But to some extent, if we don't bring youth and young adults to the table for the conversation, it's also we're missing part of the picture then of what's happening and what other strategies may be effective for prevention.
And part of this picture is that young Black men and boys experience trauma at higher levels than other groups of Americans. What trauma-informed programs or practices could help reduce gun violence?
There are many programs that are taking really a trauma-informed lens to addressing gun violence. And it is so critical both for individuals, but also on recognizing that there's carryover trauma for those that may be in the family or the social network of individuals who are impacted by gun violence, but also within neighborhoods, within the broader community. So many of the programs that I mentioned earlier, whether it be Credible Messengers, 414 Life, other programs, even within the hospital program, we have follow-up for the gunshot wound survivors that not only interact with the 414 Life program, but also go through a program called the Trauma Quality of Life Clinic, where they actually receive direct support through multiple entities, social workers, psychologists, as well as the 414 Life team, to make sure that that trauma component, as well as the medical component, is really addressed in the comprehensive wraparound care.
Talking with Constance Kostolak, the head of the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission, about a recent decrease in gun-related violence in Milwaukee. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Bill in Eau Claire is here. Bill, hi.
How are you doing?
I
have a question. Now, you guys are looking at young people and how to handle them. Has anybody looked at or even thought of firearm safety courses taught in school? So like if a child goes over to somebody's place to babysit, or if they go over to a household to play with their buddies and they happen to find one laying out, that they can look at that gun and properly know how to handle it. I know education is probably the best thing that could happen there.
Bill, thank you for that question. Constance.
We actually have multiple strategies that are focused on various components of education, and firearm safety is certainly one of them. We know that there's different opportunities, whether it be through schools or it be through other mechanisms, to get information out about firearm safety. So that definitely is one of the strategies that we've been looking at from a prevention standpoint.
The head of the Sojourner Family Peace Center recently told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that substantial challenges remain in reducing violence in the city. Where do you think additional funding would be best spent for the coming year?
So unfortunately, I think there's a lot of areas where we have the need for continued funding. I think the programs that we have in place currently could benefit from increased capacity and increased support from a funding standpoint. But we also have some more fundamental needs, the need for housing stability for families. We have work that's happening to try to specifically address some of those social determinants of health, and housing is one that comes up regularly. Additional resources to support the trauma-informed care that we were just talking about earlier, but also even in terms of the approaches to making sure that we've got opportunities and funding to work with individuals who have either been victimized by gun violence or have been involved with gun violence, to make sure that we have capacity so that referrals don't go unheeded when there's not enough funding to go around.
In our last moments together, how do we not become complacent here? How do we continue this trend?
That is really important as we head into 2024. We really need to continue to evaluate the programs that are in place to better understand what's working, who they're working for. We need to make sure that we are looking at this trend as a positive step, but only a step in the right direction. We really need to make sure that we are thinking about what else we do and do not understand currently. Where do we need additional research? Where do we need additional support to understand what's happening with particular programs? Then we can replicate those programs and look for additional funding to support them as well.
Constance, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate the opportunity to be on this morning.
Constance Kostolak is director of the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission. Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of WPR. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee and Madison have bus rapid transit projects in the works. We explore what it means for riders. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum about a unique museum in the Milwaukee area.
Cats are special companions to many people, including Sean and Hillary Redner. The couple love cats so much, they created Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum, where they display thousands of cat-related figurines from around the world. WPR producer and cat lover Trina LaSousa ventured to Menominee Falls to check out the collection.
That is cool.
Yeah, that's Alice in Wonderland.
That's what I thought.
This one Cheshire is Cat. Alice with the little rabbit. Pretty neat. Now we're going to have to make room in Jan's cabinet.
That's Hillary and Sean Redner opening a package of cat-themed teapots sent to them from Hollywood, California. Getting packages like this happens regularly since they transformed their Menominee Falls home into Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum. They started this as a personal collection back in 2018. Then after some media attention, Sean says fans started sending their own cat-themed items from all around the world.
This was the first collection that showed up. Cheryl Peters contacted us and sent me the phone number, and we got on the phone, and she's like, I'm old. My kids don't want my stuff. I've been collecting this since the 70s. Will you take care of it for me? I was like, well, sure. She goes, no, I need you to take care of it for me. And she started to get, like, forceful. I'm like, yeah, sure. Like, I had no idea what was coming. So everything in this cabinet but those two jewelry boxes has come from Lauai, Hawaii.
Inside the museum are thousands of cat statues, cookie jars, plates, pieces of artwork, nearly every cat-related decoration you could dream of. Sean says most of the Cat Museum's items are either bought from secondhand thrift stores or shared by fellow cat enthusiasts. They hope to someday beat the Guinness Book of World Records for the most unique cat-related items, which currently stands at 21,000 cats.
It's unbelievable the amount of cat stuff that is out there, you know, and it's we're not even close to finding it all.
The museum is also home to 9 friendly rescued cats. And believe it or not, the cats have not damaged any of the items. Sean says all of the pieces are protected in cabinets or secured to the walls.
Knock on wood, they're really actually pretty good. We get that question a lot. But as you can see, almost everything is locked up. We have one cat, Batgirl, who's probably hiding in the house. It's been going up and, like, being curious, but I'm hoping it's too crowded.
Donated collections have the original owner's name and location alongside the display. Some of the donations even come with letters. Here, Hillary reads a note from Heather Sweeten of Illinois, who donated nearly 100 cat thimbles.
To the folks of Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum, I am thrilled that my cat thimble collection will have a wonderful new home in your museum, on display for others to see.
Sean says the cat collecting started back in 2018 at a St. Vincent de Paul store in West Dallas. He rescued a framed photo of a cat named Taffy.
It says right on the back she lived from 1960 to 1970. The picture was taken in October of 1967. So I put it back, and I'm like, this is weird. And then I was like, wait a minute. There was Vietnam and the moon landing, and what was happening in this house while this cat was bouncing around? Like, I'm bringing that home. And now in our museum, we have a whole wall of other people's cats.
Sean and Hillary started Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum to help support cats. They donate 100% of visitor donations to feline rescues in Wisconsin. To date, about $3,000 has been raised.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new? WPR's Trina LaSousa brought us that story on Redner's Rescued Cat Figurine Museum. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As Madison and Milwaukee invest in bus rapid transit systems, we check in on the projects that are at different stages and how they might transform public transportation. And you can call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tom Lynch is Director of Transportation for Madison. Tom, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yes, and Julie Esch is with us, president of the Wisconsin Public Transit Transportation Association and deputy director of the Milwaukee County Transit System. Julie, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Julie, let's start with you. Milwaukee launching the state's first bus rapid transit line about 6 months ago. How is this system affecting public transportation around the county?
It has been a very positive impact around the county, particularly along the line itself, even more than we expected with the initial launch. It's a faster ride. It's a little more fewer stops. There's level boarding, which allows for all of our passengers, but particularly those with mobility devices, to board our buses more safely and quickly, and it helps our operators as well. And we've got very nice new modern stations along the way. And so it's really, we've gotten so many positive comments and feedback that we are now looking to do another one.
So you feel that it is really meeting the early benchmarks as you start running this type of transit system?
Yes, it is definitely, it's meeting the ridership benchmarks. It's also, you know, we get feedback from our operators as well, who have had positive comments about the system, the route itself. And so we also had some positive feedback from employers as well, because we are connecting Milwaukee's downtown all the way to the medical center in Wauwatosa.
I wonder if it's the route or is it the quickness, the convenience? What is it exactly that is drawing riders to this type of system?
It's all of those.
Okay.
There are a lot of employers along that route, and so we targeted it to start a network of bus rapid transit and to see how well it would be accepted. But as I've ridden it myself and talked to people and asked their thoughts, they find it very convenient. There are people that don't want the hassle of driving a car, maybe having to get a second or third car, and they can stop along the way as well. You know, between if they're going from downtown to the medical center, they can make some stops along the way. And then we also have our new Wisco app, which has made ridership, you know, getting routes and connecting routes, even bubbler bikes, bike share opportunities, all connected within that app. So we launched that a little bit ahead of time. And so it's really all those, really taking public transportation to the next level.
turning our attention to Madison now, Tom. Madison, modeling some of the system after what's happening in Milwaukee. Why does Madison need a similar bus rapid transit system?
Well, if you look at our major arterials that go into downtown, you know, they're really, the capacity of them is fixed. You know, we are not going to be adding lanes to East Washington Avenue. We're not going to be adding lanes to University Avenue. We're not going to be adding lanes to Mineral Point. So we need to find a way to get more people to the places they need to go without, you know, relying on the car. This kind of takes us, just as Julie said, to the next step. We needed a modern, frequent, and fast transit system that could serve a lot of the needs that we have for people getting to jobs and to services.
And Tom, can you take a moment here and describe the funding structure? It's expected to cost about $194 million. This is a mix of federal grants, local funding. How much is the city expected to pay of the total?
Yeah, it's a rather creative funding structure. It's 72% federally funded. The city is, and our partners are doing the other 28%. We are able to use some things like a kind of a contribution of land for staging that allows us to kind of decrease the cost to the city. After the route is constructed, we're able to take back that land and build transit supportive land uses. So while it's 28% locally funded, the actual cost to the taxpayer is less.
Julie, in Milwaukee, in terms of funding, I wonder, we know that there are the federal funds coming from the infrastructure law. Would we be seeing this bus rapid transit now in cities like Milwaukee if it weren't for the federal funding?
We received a Small Starts grant from the federal government prior to that infrastructure bill.
Okay.
The infrastructure bill is allowing us to do other things, though, to free up money, you know, for future planning of other routes.
And so with Milwaukee's system, how are the area bus routes connecting with this new rapid bus line?
They are connecting at, you know, various points along the way. There have been some changes to our existing, previously existing Route 30 and our Gold Line that to make some of those connections with downtown, but the connections have been worked and integrated with the, we did a plan about 3 years ago to called MCTS Next to provide a little bit faster, efficient service. And so those two models were integrated. And that's what we're, you know, continuing to do is integrate faster, more efficient service, whether it's our existing lines or the existing, you know, new bus rapid transit line and future ones to make those transitions smooth.
We have Wisconsin Public Transportation Association President Julie Esch with us, Deputy Director of the Milwaukee County Transit System. Tom Lynch is here, leads transportation for the City of Madison, as we discuss changes in public transit. Add your question, share your thoughts, getting from point A to point B, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Madison and Milwaukee roll out a revamped model for public transportation, we learn about what bus rapid transit systems will offer riders, and you can join the discussion by asking a question or sharing your views. The number is 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tom Lynch leads transportation for the City of Madison. Julie Esch is president of the Wisconsin Public Transportation Association and deputy director of the Milwaukee County Transit System. Tom, talking about timelines and construction in Madison for bus rapid transit, the line is expected to start running by the end of this year, I understand. A second line expected to start running by 2027. Why will this project take several years to complete?
Yeah, it's a $194 million project. If this were a road project, it would span 2 years. And in essence, this is 32 individual projects because we have 32 individual stations. We're probably about 30 to 40% completed now, hoping the spring will be productive. We'd like to be running by October. Justin Sternberg, our general manager, would like to see if we could make it even by September. That would be the most favorable.
And meanwhile, as my family and I drive by these stations in progress, I'm wondering if you could give us a visual and what riders will be able to do at these stations, what they look like or will look like.
Yeah, our bus rapid transit is maybe different than some others in that we'll be using center running lanes for the majority of it, which means our stations will be in the center. This allows kind of the buses not to be hindered by right turning vehicles, not to be hindered by, you know, the UPS or Amazon trucks that often will park on the curb. It'll provide a faster ride. Our stations are, I'll say they're prominent. They have a distinct architectural look because we had a design competition to provide us with kind of the concept of it. They'll have seating. They will have push button heat. The platforms will be raised. So if you are mobility impaired, you'll have level boarding, let's say for a wheelchair. They'll be spaced roughly about every half mile. They'll have TVs in them that will kind of tell when the next bus will be coming. All of our service will have at least 15-minute frequency, but much of our service will have either 7 or 5-minute frequency. So you won't have to check a schedule to see when the next bus is coming, because if you go to the station, there will always be a next bus coming.
Hmm. Julie, as you hear this list of amenities and you look at your own amenities in Milwaukee that are much different than what it was like to ride a bus, you know, just maybe last year or 10 years ago, are riders expecting these types of services now?
Yes, they definitely are. Riders are very sophisticated. They want to have a very well-connected, you know, modernized technology and, you know, with our public transportation. So we feel like we're trying to catch up and maybe get a little bit beyond what their expectations are.
Meanwhile, people are able to ride the new bus rapid transit system for free. Why is the line temporarily free to ride?
We are being sponsored by our ticket vending machine operator. There have been some delays in supply chain. Unfortunately, those are some of the issues we've encountered. As you were asking Tom about why bus, you know, rapid transit lines take so long, sometimes there's a lot of engineering and those basic, you know, cutting open the roads and providing electrical infrastructure to all the stations. But then there are also, we continue to see supply chain management issues along the way as well.
Have those supply chain management issues been a setback in terms of the time to be able to offer these services and services in the future?
We've been able to make workarounds, which is what we've done, and just kept our ridership, you know, informed along the way as to, you know, what to expect next. But no, we want to keep moving forward the best that we can with what we have available, and then, you know, looking forward to completing the entire package, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Tom, free rides in Milwaukee for the time being. Will Madison offer that type of rollout?
We're hoping that our ticketing will be up and running when our BRT launches. But just as Julie said, you know, supply chain issues are a thing. And so we'll have to get our ticketing set up with 32 different stations. We'll have to have communications to those stations. We'll have to have the equipment working. We're also kind of instituting a new fare system this summer. So there's a whole bunch of moving parts. And so we're hoping that they all fit together, but perhaps we may be in a situation where we'll have to do something like that as well.
Tom Lynch leads transportation services in Madison. Julie Esch with us, deputy director of the Milwaukee County Transit System. As we look at new rapid transit options in Madison and Milwaukee, you can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Julie, as you look to the future with Milwaukee, other cities in Wisconsin, does bus rapid transit mean that light rail is not part of a city's future?
I would never rule out light rail or other types of public transportation. I think right now, the bus rapid transit, you know, is the way to go. The rubber tire, you know, there's flexibility in that. It's cheaper. And it's been a good next step for us, and at least in the Milwaukee region.
Frank in Springbrook called in to ask, how do you get people who don't live on main arteries to this rapid system line? Julie?
If they cannot take the any of the existing routes, that does become more difficult. We do not have a last mile option at the moment. There is an organization in the area, Mobilize, that runs FlexRide that does try to provide that, but that can become tricky if they cannot reach an existing route through walking or bicycling.
And bicycling, Tom, you know, that is something that Madison prides itself on. How do you integrate and coordinate with biking, especially bike lanes, and then, you know, there's car traffic in the mix?
Yeah, well, our buses will be able to store bikes. We hope to have parking by most of our stations for bikes. And in some instances, we're able to actually improve some of the biking facilities right now on Mineral Point Road. Cyclists ride on the road, basically, for 2.5 miles. We'll be letting a construction project that will put a new path on the north side, so that'll be a protected facility for cyclists, and we're doing that as part of the bus rapid transit. However, other corridors like East Washington Avenue, you know, there will be some detrimental effects to bicycle facilities. It's during the rush hour. It's not preferred, but we're doing everything we can to make biking to the station or biking along the route as safe as possible.
Well, Tom and Julie, thank you so much for these transportation updates. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Julie Esch is president of the Wisconsin Public Transportation Association and deputy director of the Milwaukee County Transit System. Tom Lynch leads Madison's transportation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.